The book of Job is indeed a fascinating book. Victor Hugo once made this comment: "The book of Job is perhaps the greatest masterpiece of the human mind, not just in the Bible, but the greatest piece of literature ever handed down in the form of a book." When we look at the book of Job from a literary sense, we recognize that it contains all the qualities that would definitely assure it of a Nobel Prize in literature if it had been written today. It is a masterpiece, a literary epic. It's a drama. It's a magnificent piece of literary work. The book of Job breaks down into three compartments. There is a prologue, which is followed by a dialogue, which finally ends in an epilogue. There are two parts of the book, in essence. There's the part that's written in prose, or the narrative portions, which are the first two chapters and the last chapter. And then there's the poetry, which make up the middle of the book, the dialogue that goes back and forth, the banter back and forth between Job and his friends. That's all written in Hebrew poetry. 39 chapters of Hebrew poetry. We're going to learn a lot about Hebrew poetry. It's a lot different from today's poetry. Today we depend on the rhyming of words to make our poems. But the Hebrews depended not on the rhyming of words, but on the rhyming of thoughts or ideas. Hebrew poetry consisted of parallelism, paralleling one thought with another, maybe paralleling one thought and then saying it again in a different way in the next three or four stanzas. And so we're going to learn a lot about Hebrew poetry. In fact, you're going to find out that it's very complex and it's very complicated, and it's not necessarily an easy thing to study and to grasp, at least for us coming at it from a Western mindset. There are many who believe that the book of Job was structured in such a way to where it could be dramatically portrayed, that the dialogue from chapters 3 through chapters 41 were actually intended to be acted out on a stage among actors. The first part, the prologue, and then the last part, the epilogue, would be sort of contained in the program notes. They were what set the stage and what sort of culminated it at the end. But all that happened in between was to be acted out. It was presented in a way that where it would be dramatized, and where people could really catch the emotion and the pathos that's contained in these arguments that are going back and forth between Job and his friends as they grapple about some of the most basic issues to life, some of the foundational understandings that are necessary for living and existing in this fallen world are found in the book of Job. Now, the book of Job, though, is more than just a literary masterpiece, because the book of Job is a story about a man, a historical figure, a man by the name of Job. There are people who say that Job was actually a fictional character and the whole story is just sort of conjured up in order to explore these philosophical questions. But that's not what the Bible teaches. In Ezekiel chapter 14, verse 20, there Ezekiel treats Job as a real historical individual. He mentions Job in the same breath as with Noah and Daniel. We also know that James, in chapter 5, verse 11, he treats Job as a real figure. He talks about the patience of Job and what we learn from the story of Job. And so Job was a real individual. Job probably lived during the time of the patriarchs, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. He probably was actually a contemporary of Jacob and then later Joseph, who lived in Egypt. And so while the children of Israel were getting settled and comfortable in Egypt, this story of Job was going on back in Edom. In Genesis chapter 36, there is a Jobab who is mentioned in the ancestry of Esau. He was one of the kings of Edom. And it could well be that this Job was the Jobab of Genesis chapter 36. There's a lot of evidence in the book that places Job during the time of the patriarchs. He lived in a place called Uz, which was the region between Palestine and Arabia. It was the place a little north of Edom. It was more or less a wilderness area for the most part. It bordered against the territory of the Midianites. Now, if Job was, if he did live during the time of the patriarchs, this would make the book of Job the oldest book in the Bible. Or at least it's the oldest in terms of when it was written. We don't know who actually authored the book of Job. Of course, we know God did. But we don't know the human instrument that God used. Jewish tradition, though, staunchly asserts that Moses was the author of the book of Job. That is possible, if not probable. You remember, Moses spent 40 years in God's penalty box, you know, on the backside of the wilderness. And you remember, he lived among the Midianites. And it's interesting that the Midianites were neighbors of the Edomites, or the descendants of Esau. And perhaps it was there that Moses became familiar with the story of Job. Perhaps he met one of Job's sons, grandsons. May have even met Job himself. But it was there that Moses was handed the story and the epic of Job and Job's sufferings. It's interesting that an old manuscript, an ancient document, an ancient story, has such interesting insights and implications for modern man. Job is an old story, but Job's meanings and the principles that it teaches are as relevant as the morning newspaper. You know, this is a story that's made for our modern society. We begin in verse 1. There was a man in the land of Uz whose name was Job. And that man was blameless and upright, and one who feared God and shunned evil. Now that's quite an introduction. That's quite a resume of righteousness. Job had a great track record, and here he gets a tremendous commendation that he is blameless and upright. Now understand, that doesn't mean that Job was sinless. There is no such thing as a sinless person. The only sinless person has been Jesus Christ. The Bible tells us in Romans chapter 3 that we've all sinned and come short of the glory of God. So we know that Job sinned. We know that he fell short of God's standards and God's glory. And yet what made Job blameless, he wasn't sinless, but he was blameless. And what made Job blameless was that he knew how to handle his sin. He knew how to treat and deal with his sin once he had sinned. He knew the importance of offering a sacrifice. And he was faithful to sacrificing for his sins and keeping his accounts clear with God. Keeping his heavenly accounts on the up and up. And so he settled his accounts. He settled his debts. He dealt with his sin through confession and sacrifice. And he remained blameless, spotless in the eyes of God. It's also evident from the book that Job had a heart of devotion. Job loved the Lord. And he was a sincere man. He had a sincere faith. And he had a sincere love for God, as we'll see. He feared God, and he shunned evil. Notice the point that the author is trying to make is that none of these sufferings that Job has to experience, none of the sufferings that he's forced to endure are his fault. He has committed no sin that would deserve such terrible circumstances and such terrible plight and misery. Job was innocent. Job was an innocent sufferer in all that he experienced. And we'll see many more cases where Job's righteousness is vindicated in the face of his sufferings. And he had 7 sons, and 3 daughters were born to him. Also, his possessions were 7,000 sheep, 3,000 camels, 500 yoke of oxen, 500 female donkeys, and a very large household. So that this man was the greatest of all the people of the East. Now, Job obviously lived in a day where they measured a man's wealth based on his livestock. And Job really had the beef. I mean, he really had the cattle. He had the livestock. He was a very wealthy man. God had blessed him and God had prospered him. Apparently, Job, everything Job had put his hand to, turned to gold. He had the Midas touch, in a sense. And so Job was a very prosperous man. It is interesting that during the times of the patriarchs, this would fit, because this was also a time when they measured a man's wealth based on his livestock. There's also some interesting things in the book of Job, or some interesting absences, you might say, that lead us to believe that he was a contemporary of Joseph, that he lived among Jacob and Isaac. And that is the fact that there is missing from this whole record any account of the institutions of Judaism. The temple, the tabernacle, the sacrifices, the Levitical holidays and feast days, the Levitical priesthood. In fact, Job lived in a day when he was his own priest, when the man was the head of the house and the priest of the family, when the man himself went and offered sacrifices on behalf of the family. And Job was faithful to do that. Job loved his family. It says he had 7 sons and he had 3 daughters. He was a family man. And we see just how much he loved his family in the next few verses. Now his sons would go and feast in their houses. One other thing, we should add that it says here that he was the greatest of all the people of the East. He's not just talking about his wealth there. Job was also a great man in terms of character, in terms of the kind of man that he was. Let me read to you what one commentary puts together based on its gleanings from all the other passages and little inferences that are dropped throughout the remainder of the book. It says, Job was an honored judge in his hometown, noted for his fairness, integrity, compassion, and his strong and compelling sense of justness. The young men of the city deferred to him, and the old ones stood in honor whenever he entered the room. His advice was sought by all. Everyone listened when he spoke. In fact, it was generally agreed by all in Uz that when Job spoke, there was nothing more to be added. The widows, in their loneliness, were clothed and fed by his generosity. Everybody spoke well of Job. The blind often felt the gentle touch of his strong hands as he led them in their darkness. The lame were never left to their helplessness when Job was present. Even the strangers were welcomed by the greatness of this gracious gentleman. There was no man in all the earth like Job. I'm sure Job made man of the year in Uz many years in succession. He was the greatest man in all the East, both in terms of his wealth and also in terms of his righteousness. And then notice, now his sons would go and feast in their houses, each on his appointed day. Now, there's some people that believe here that they were celebrating their birthdays. The idea of each in his own appointed day. The idea that everybody had a special day, and so they were having birthday parties. And whenever one of the brothers would have a birthday, he'd throw a big feast over at his house, invite all the rest of his family over, and he would send and invite their 3 sisters to eat and drink with them. And so it was, when the days of feasting had run their course, that Job would send and sanctify them, and he would rise early in the morning and offer burnt offerings according to the number of them all. For Job said, "It may be that my sons have sinned and cursed God in their hearts." And thus Job did regularly. And Job was just wanting to be precautious. And he was really a man who loved his family. And he was afraid that maybe in their partying and maybe in the feast, maybe they'd said something that they regretted. You know, maybe they thought something in their heart. And he just wanted to be on the safe side. So even after their feasting, he'd go and he'd offer sacrifices on behalf of his family. There was nothing that mattered more to Job than God's favor and God's pleasure. He took great stock in the fact that God had blessed him. And he derived from that God loved him and that God was pleased with him. And Job was a man who wanted nothing else in the world but to please God and to glorify Him. Now there wasn't a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord. Now suddenly the scene shifts. You know, we've been focusing on Job in the land of Uz, but suddenly the cameras now swing and pivot upward. And now we look into the throne room of God in heaven. We move from earth, now we see heaven. And there was a day when the sons of God, and this is an expression, of course, of the angels. In the Hebrew, it's the word Bnei Elohim, and it's always used in reference to the angels. And so the angels had gathered together, sort of in conference, and they came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came among them. Now this may surprise some of you. You know, a lot of us have the naive idea that Satan's somewhere off in hell, that that's where Satan lives. Listen, that's the last place Satan wants to be, in hell. You know, we're surprised, on the other hand, though, to see Satan actually in heaven. You know, that's kind of a shock. Now, we know that at one time Satan lived in heaven, because Satan was the archangel of God. He was the anointed cherub that covered the throne of God before pride entered into his heart. And God cast Satan, bounced him out on his ear, out of heaven. And yet, though Satan fell from his position and from his privileges and from his glory, apparently Satan maintains his access to the throne of God. And so Satan comes to and fro. He enters into the presence of God and he comes back out of the presence of God. Now we know that eventually Satan will be taken care of. In Revelation chapter 12, we're told that in the middle of the great tribulation, when the Antichrist sets himself up as God in the rebuilt temple, that God will have had enough of Satan. And it says there that Satan is booted out of heaven permanently. And Satan realizes at that point that his days are numbered. And so you know what he does when he leaves. He goes out and he immediately turns to Israel to try to destroy God's people. Remember what the word Satan means. Does anybody know? It's the word adversary. It's literally what Satan means. Satan is our adversary. Satan is a prosecuting attorney. And I believe Satan is constantly going into the throne room of God. He's barging in before the bar of God. And he's trying to present evidence against you and against me. He's got videotapes of all our little sins and all the little things that we've done and the ways that we've blown it. And he's constantly going in before God trying to get our sainthood and our salvation annulled. That's why Jesus Christ is there. And you know what Christ is doing? He is making intercession for the saints. He is our advocate, or our lawyer, our defense attorney. And every time Satan he comes on and he says, look at Brian down there. Look what a bozo he is. He's got no right to be a child of God. I've got evidence right here that supports that. And just about the time he throws up his evidence, Christ steps in and he says, wait a minute, that's inadmissible evidence. That's under the blood of Jesus Christ. And so Christ is there working on our behalf. You know, ruling out that which is under the blood. And whatever's under the blood of Christ is inadmissible evidence in the court of God. And so Satan's coming in. And here he comes in. He comes and he approaches God, as do the other angels. And the Lord said to Satan, from where do you come? And so Satan answered the Lord and said, from going to and fro on the earth and from walking back and forth on it. Now that's only half the story. What else has he been doing? You remember what Peter tells us? He says, be sober, be vigilant, for your adversary the devil walks about. That's all Satan said. But Peter says he walks about like a roaring lion, seeking whom he may devour. That's what he's really been up to. He's been out combing the grounds, trying to stir up sin and cause mischief. And then the Lord said to Satan, have you considered my servant Job, that there is none like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man, one who fears God and shuns evil? Now, very seldom do we get the opportunity to overhear the dialogue that's going on in heaven. It is true that on occasion we're given a glimpse of heaven, and there we see the angels praising and glorifying God. And so we always know that heaven is sort of covered in an atmosphere of praise and worship. But as far as being able to stretch our ears a little closer and actually be able to hear what God is saying to his associates, or I don't know if God even has associates, but to his servants. Here we get the opportunity. And it's interesting, it seems that always, whenever we hear what God is saying, He's always talking about His people. That blows my mind. We should all be flattered. What is on the tip of God's tongue? What is the thing that God can't stop talking about? And that's how much He loves His people. How much He cares about His kids. He's like any proud father. Especially when he sees someone doing his will. His chest puffs out. He gets excited. He boasts. He says, "Look at my son Pete, who loves me, who serves me, who shuns evil, and who fears God." God takes great pleasure and great pride in His kids and in what His kids are doing. Now, Satan knows that. And that's why we have become satanic targets. Because you see, in order to get to God, Satan has found that one of the best ways to rile Him, one of the best ways to insult Him and to degrade Him, is by degrading His children and by dragging down His kids. You see, there's a cosmic battle going on in the universe. There are spiritual heavyweights slugging it out. And what's happened is that you and I have gotten caught in the crossfire. You know, our faith is like the land on the Kuwaiti-Saudi border. I mean, there are two armies there fighting it out over that piece of land. And there are spiritual heavyweights in the universe fighting it out over your faith. They're fighting for your devotion. They're battling for your allegiance. On the one hand, God is proud when you obey Him and when you have faith in Him and when you walk with Him. On the other hand, when you don't, He is humiliated. And Satan is able to come and to mock Him in a sense. And say, "Look at your kid stumbling. Look at your kid falling." Not that that's admissible evidence. But it's just something that Satan is able to sort of needle God with. You know, his honor is at stake in the behavior of his kids. And so Satan answered the Lord and said, "Does Job fear God for nothing? Have you not made a hedge around him, around his household and around all that he has on every side? You've blessed the work of his hands, and his possessions have increased in the land. But now stretch out your hand and touch all that he has, and he will surely curse you to your face." Now, Satan accuses God of having padded the deck, you know, of having rigged Job's righteousness. He says, "Look, you've made it easy for Job. Of course Job's going to love you. Look at what you've done for him." You know, and Satan is very cynical. He's cynical about Job's motives. Satan doesn't believe that it's possible for anyone to serve God without self-centered motivations. Satan doesn't think it's possible for anyone to serve God unless it's through their own self-interest. You know, Satan is accusing Job here of serving God for a meal ticket. You know, that Job's faith is really little more than a coin through which Job is buying God's blessing. And Satan says, "I'll prove it to you. You just take this hedge away from Job. Take this hedge out from around him. And let me touch him. Let some harm come to him. And it'll become evident the nature of his faith and his devotion. He'll curse you right to your face." It is astonishing that God's honor and God's glory in heaven is riding on your faithfulness and on your allegiance to God. That's sobering. You know, that my reactions and my attitudes, you know, either enhance God's glory or else give Satan and the enemy an opportunity to degrade God and to drag him down and to diminish his glory. Now, nothing, obviously, can happen to us unless God at least allows it. And we infer this from the passage. Satan had to have permission to touch Job. And it's interesting to me that nothing can happen to me that it doesn't first pass across God's desk. Nothing can happen to you that doesn't first pass across God's desk. But God does at times allow evil to come our way in order to test us, in order to determine the real nature of our allegiance. And He does it not so much for His own benefit, because I'm sure God was able to look into the heart of Job, and God was able to see exactly the nature of Job's faith, that it was sincere, that it was legitimate. But the reason God puts us to the test is not for His own benefit, but it's because of the people there in heaven, the spectators, the crowd. You know, do you realize that there are wars being waged in the very throne room of God, where your reaction, your devotion, is actually the hinge on which God either gets the victory or Satan gets the victory. There are cosmic struggles going on. And you and I are here on earth, and things happen to us, and we treat them so flippantly and so trivial, and yet God's glory in heaven hinges on our reaction to those things. How we handle that flat tire will determine either God's glory or God's humiliation in heaven. How we handle it when we burn the cake that we were cooking, we go off and leave it and burn it to a crisp. How we handle that may be a cosmic test. We treat it so flippantly. But every eye in heaven may be zeroed in on you after you've burned that cake. Paul says in 1 Corinthians chapter 4, he says that we have been made spectacles to the angels. You know, that the heavenly grandstand has their attention zeroed in on you right here on earth. And your reaction to the boss, your reaction to the circumstances and to the events around you, may have enormous implications and enormous consequences in heaven. That's sobering. To give you an illustration of how God feels about it, let's pretend you were taking your kid to a advanced placement program. You were enrolling him in a very special class at school. And it was a prestigious thing for your kid to be in that class. But before he was accepted, he first had to go through a battery of tests. His IQ was going to be tested. His social skills were going to be tested. His academic knowledge, you know, was going to be tested. Now, the morning comes when the tests are to be issued. And you're a little nervous, aren't you? Because there's a lot riding on these tests as far as you're concerned. I mean, your skills as a parent are going to be tested along with your child. You know, your abilities, your loving care over your child is going to be tested. You know, even the caliber of your genes are going to be put to the test. I mean, you're a little nervous and you're a little bit apprehensive because you realize that your esteem as a parent is riding on the success of your child's test. And then suddenly the morning comes, you get ready, you go out to the car, and you look over, and there's your kid over wallowing in a mud puddle. He's totally oblivious to it. And yet for you, so much is riding on that test. I just believe that's how God feels. So much is riding a lot of times on the circumstances and events and our reactions to those circumstances. And yet we treat those circumstances so flippantly and so trivially. And we get angry and we get upset. And we don't realize what was actually going on in heaven and what that whole scenario actually meant. from the eternal perspective. Let us also point out the fact that this passage proves to us that God is sovereign, not only over human beings, but God is also sovereign over Satan. That God is in control over satanic forces. He is in control over Satan's maneuverings and over Satan's manipulations and exploits. God has Satan on a leash, and God has set limits for Satan. Now, you see, there is an idea in philosophy called dualism. And it's the belief that there are two eternal forces existing simultaneously in the universe, good and evil. And the two are on an equal par, and they're slugging it out with each other, but the two, in essence, are equal. You see this idea of dualism occurring in literature a lot, even in the Star Wars trilogy. You know, there's the idea of, you know, the good side of the Force and the evil side of the Force, but it's not that one is superior to the other. There's just two eternal forces there knocking it out with each other. Don't be deceived by dualism. There is only one eternal force in the universe, and that is God. Good remains sovereign over evil. God remains sovereign over Satan. Satan could be annihilated instantaneously at the command of God if God so desired. But God is allowing Satan to operate in order to help fulfill his purposes. And yet God remains in control over Satan. Satan can't even sneeze without getting permission. Notice he comes to that. He can't touch Job. He can't do one thing to Job without first getting God's permission. You know, I think we give Satan too much credit sometimes. Now, not to discredit him. He is powerful. He is potent, but he is not omnipotent. Only God is omnipotent. And God has set limits for Satan. And you'll notice in this thing, Satan never pushes those limits. Satan never questions those limits. You don't see Satan in here arguing over those limits. Satan knows his place. Now, he will work within those limits. I mean, he'll exploit those limits to the greatest degree that he can. I mean, he'll take it to the edge. But he'll never violate those limits. He'll never step over those limits. He can only act within the limitations that God has put on him. And it's interesting here that even when he gets frustrated, even when his plan fails, he has to go back to God to change the rules. He can't change the rules himself. He can't get in the middle of things and change the rules. He is stuck within the limitations that God has given him. There was no way that Satan could have touched Job had not God lifted the hedge around Job. You know, Satan would love to destroy and wipe out each one of us. And you know why he doesn't. There's only one reason he doesn't. It's because he can't. It's because God has a hedge about us. He has a protective encasement around us. Satan would love to wipe you out, but he can't. He can't touch you unless God gives him permission. Now, that being the case, that puts a whole new light on the trials and the sufferings and the pains that we have to experience in our lives. That nothing can come to us unless it passes across God's desk first. In other words, all of our pains, all of our sufferings, all of our trials are Father-filtered. They have to come through the arms of a loving God before they reach us. Therefore, they must have an important purpose, an important reason attached to them if they make it as far as us. Now, the Lord responds to Satan, and he says, "Behold, all that he has is in your power. Only do not lay a hand on his person." He gives him his possessions, but he says, "Stay off his person." Then Satan went out from the presence of the Lord. And notice he doesn't waste any time. I mean, Satan wants to snuff you out. He wants to do damage to you. And when he's given the opportunity, he's quick to take advantage of it. The only reason he doesn't, and the only reason we're not more beset with problems and troubles than we are, is because God's put a hedge about us. Now, there was a day when his sons and daughters were eating and drinking wine in their oldest brother's house. And a messenger came to Job and said, "The oxen were plowing and the donkeys feeding beside them. When the Sabians raided them and took them away, indeed they have killed the servants with the edge of the sword, and I alone have escaped to tell you." Now, what devastating news. Your entire fortune's been wiped out. All your wealth is gone in one afternoon. Job went from a rich man to poverty instantly in this one raid by the Sabians. But while he was still speaking, as if that was not enough, another also came and said, "The fire of God fell from heaven and burned up the sheep and the servants and consumed them, and I alone have escaped to tell you." Now, I mean, this is even while the first bit of bad news hasn't even settled yet before this next bit of bad news comes. The fire of God here probably refers to a lightning bolt that struck and that consumed them. It is interesting that Satan does seem to have the power to manipulate nature, to maneuver nature. I mean, it does seem that he has that power, that he can cause, natural disasters and natural calamities. You remember when Jesus was asleep on the back of the boat and the storm popped up on the Sea of Galilee? And it really started rocking. You know, the waves were high and the boat was swinging. And you remember how the disciples really went into a panic. And they went to the back of the boat and they woke Jesus up. Remember what Jesus did? It says he stood up. And what did he do to the winds and the waves? He rebuked them. Now, you rebuke a demon. That's what you do to a demon. You rebuke him. And yet Jesus rebuked the winds and the waves. Perhaps he was rebuking the demonic forces that were trying to sink our salvation. Now, while he was still speaking, another came and said, "The Chaldeans formed three bands, raided the camels and took them away, yes, and killed the servants with the edge of the sword. And I alone have escaped to tell you." Wow. And while he was still speaking, another also came and said, "Your sons and daughters were eating and drinking wine in their oldest brother's house. And suddenly a great wind, or tornado maybe, came from across the wilderness and struck the four corners of the house. And it fell on the young men, and they are dead. And I alone have escaped to tell you." Now, that's amazing. You know, all in the space of maybe an hour. I mean, one right after another, like dominoes falling. All this bad news comes upon Job. An incredible array of bad news. Now, you know, we all have our bad news. We all have trials that we're working through. Perhaps you got some bad news in the mail today. But let me suggest to you that none of us have it as bad as Job. Is there anybody here that has more troubles than Job? I didn't think so. I mean, here's more than one man you'd think is capable of bearing. This is incredible. In one afternoon, his fortunes are wiped out, his friends are destroyed, and his family is killed. In one afternoon. Now, you've all heard of the stress factor index, where they take the little things that can possibly happen to you and they give them, in terms of the stress that it brings to bear on your life, and they give them a numerical value. And you add it up and you see what kind of stress, you're under. They say that 79% of the people that experience a stress index of more than 300 end up experiencing some kind of major illness shortly thereafter. Some of the things they've put down: the death of a spouse is equal to 100. The death of a close family member, 63. Being fired from a job, 47. pregnancy, 40 for the wife, 100 for the husband. Just kidding. Foreclosure on a mortgage, 30. Changing to a new school, 20. You get the idea. I figured up Job's stress factor index. It's 650. I mean, this guy had a hard day at the office. 650. I mean, this guy, if anybody deserves to be stressed out, it's Job. But notice what Job says in response. It says, he arose and he tore his robe and he shaved his head and he fell to the ground and he worshipped. And he said, naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked shall I return there. The Lord gave, and the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. And in all this, Job did not sin, nor charged God with wrong. Now, what would you have done if this had happened to you? That's the question. What would you have done? There's a lot of things I probably would have done, but worship would probably not have been one of them. And yet it says that after all this had happened, Job tore his clothes. He shaved his head as a sign that his glory had departed. And he sat down and he began to worship God. That's incredible. You see, Satan was wrong. Job's devotion was sincere. Job served God not for what he could get out of God. He served God for who He is. He served God because He was worthy and because He was deserving of His worship. Let me ask you a question. Is your faith little more than a meal ticket? Is it a coin that you expect to plug into the heavenly dispenser and get back out a blessing? Are you serving God for what He can do for you? There's one way to tell, and that's how you, when troubles come, when trials come. How do you respond when your faith is put to the test? And if you're a new Christian, let me suggest to you that your faith will be put to the test. You fellas know that a metal doesn't gain its strength until it's first been tempered in the fire. And a Christian doesn't gain its strength until it's first tempered in the fire, until its faith is tested, to see what kind of faith it is. Now, there are many Christians today that have bought into this whole Christianity idea as a way of gaining health and wealth. That's what they're after. Riches and rewards. They're only after God as a means of blessing them. Notice what Job says. You know, naked came out of my mother's womb. Naked do I return. The Lord gives, the Lord takes away. And what? Blessed be the name of the Lord. I'm not concerned about me getting God's blessing. I'm concerned about my life being a blessing to God. I'm not concerned about God making me happy. I'm concerned about me making God happy. That's what I'm concerned about. Now, don't misunderstand. There are a lot of us, when we came to Christ, we came out of a need. We came in desperation. And we had a big need, and so we came to Christ. And that's okay. Whatever gets you there, that's fine. But once you get to Christ, and once you begin to learn who He is and what He is, once you begin to discover His glory and His beauty, there's something wrong unless you don't gain a respect for His greatness and His glory, and you don't begin to start worshiping Him because He deserves it and because He's worthy. If you still maintain that meal ticket faith, that meal ticket mentality, there's something wrong with your faith. God is worthy to be worshipped. If He never blessed us again, if the flow of blessings were suddenly shut off, if He never touched our life with a good thing again, God is still worthy to be worshipped. He's still worthy to be served. And Job is willing to say, look, he says, God didn't owe me anything. I didn't come into this world with anything. He doesn't owe me anything. And if He chooses that I not leave this world with anything, so be it. Blessed be the name of the Lord. And amazingly, the Bible says, in all this, Job did not sin nor charge God with wrong. Again, the Bible vindicating Job's attitude. These things that happened to him were not things that he deserved. There were other reasons behind them. Now again, there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord. And Satan came also among them to present himself before the Lord. And now Satan doesn't give up so easily. I mean, round one, God wins. But now Satan's wanting to go back to change the rules. He wants to change this thing a little bit, and he wants to challenge God again. And the Lord said to Satan, "From where do you come?" And so Satan answered the Lord and said, "From going to and fro on the earth, and from walking back and forth on it." Then the Lord said to Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job, that there is none like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man, one who fears God and shuns evil, and still he holds fast to his integrity, although you incited me against him to destroy him without cause?" Notice that. Without cause. From the lips of God, Job is vindicated. None of this had anything to do with Job. And you see, that's the amazing thing. The trial that you're going through, the struggle that you're going through, you're pulling your hair out. You're trying to figure out, why is this happening to me? Why is this happening to me? Do you realize that the reason for that trial may not have anything in the world to do with you? You're sitting there and you're saying, "What have I done to deserve this? Why is this happening?" And you're in all sorts of anguish over it. It may have nothing, absolutely nothing to do with you. Heaven may be watching you. This may be something that the stakes are in heaven, not here on earth. And God may have chosen you out, picked you out because of His favor, because of His love, in order to use you as an example that will bring praise and glory and honor to God. You know, we all want to bring praise and honor and glory to God. We all say we do. So God, just bless me and show your glory. But what if God chooses to show His glory by cursing you? What if God chooses to challenge Satan with you? Do what you want to him. He loves me. I can trust him. I can trust him to be faithful to me. Now, there's another interesting point here. And that is, notice that God is the one who has initiated this thing. You know, we get the idea sometimes that Satan just kind of barged in and challenged God. But no, God was the one that brought up Job. The first time it happened, and now the second time. And apparently God knows the reaction that's going to take place in Satan. And I believe that God's plan, though it includes this heavenly challenge, I think God's plan included more for Job. I think God was doing all this because He wanted to teach Job some things. I believe that God wanted to deepen Job's understanding of himself. A lot of times we talk about the book of Job and we think it's a story about why bad things happen to good people, but that's really a minor part of the story. There's a bigger issue in the book of Job, and that is, who is God? You know, what rights does God have? How far does God's jurisdiction go? How far does His sovereignty go? And how is man going to handle the sovereignty of God? That's the larger issue in the book of Job. And you see, this whole story, God is really teaching Job some important lessons. Really a lesson that if you learn it, it really doesn't matter what else you know. You've got the most important lesson. But if you don't learn it, you can learn everything else and not know anything about life. It's, do you submit to the sovereignty of God? Do you understand God's sovereignty? Is God God in your life? Or is He just a heavenly dispenser? Or is He somebody that's there for you, who lives for you? Or do you really live for God? That's what's going on here. C.S. Lewis said, God whispers to us in our pleasures. God speaks to us in our conscience. But God shouts to us in our pain. Pain is God's megaphone to rouse a deaf world. Some of God's deepest lessons come in our deepest pain. And so Satan answered the Lord and he said, "Skin for skin." Again, that cynical attitude of Satan. "Yes, all that a man has he will give for his life. But stretch out your hand now and touch his bone and his flesh, and he will surely curse you to your face." In other words, God, everybody has a price. Everybody can be bought. You know, so what? Job doesn't care that much about his possessions. But just touch his person and watch how he turns on you. He'll turn on you just like that. And so the Lord said to Satan, "Behold, he is in your hand, but spare his life." Now you think it could get no worse for Job, but it's about to. And then Satan went out from the presence of the Lord, and he struck Job with painful boils from the sole of his foot to the crown of his head. And he took for himself a potsherd with which to scrape himself. A potsherd was a broken piece of pottery. Apparently the boils were inflamed and scabbing over, and they were itching him, and he couldn't stand it, and so he just grabbed a broken piece of pottery and he started scraping the scabs off the infectious sores and all in order to try to relieve his pain. Trying to gross you out there a little bit. And so he took for himself a potsherd with which to scrape himself while he sat in the midst of the ashes. Now there's a lot of speculation over just exactly what it was that Job contracted. What kind of disease did he actually suffer from? Some say it was leprosy, but it's really unclear as to the exact nature of the disease. There are lots of different ideas if you read the commentaries. But just to show you that there was more to it than just the boils, as if that was not enough, let me read to you a description of all that Job was going through based on what he mentions and drops here and there throughout the rest of the book. More or less, let's pull out his chart, in a sense, and let's look at all the symptoms, all the things that Job is suffering with here. In chapter 2, verse 7, he has degenerative changes in his facial skin. 3, verse 24, a loss of appetite. Chapter 3, verse 25, depression. Chapter 7, verse 5, worms were in the boils. Chapter 7, verse 5, he had hardened skin and running sores. Chapter 7, verse 14, all this was being accompanied by terrifying nightmares. Chapter 9, verse 18, he had difficulty in breathing. Chapter 16, verse 16, he had dark eyelids. Chapter 19, verse 17, he had foul breath. Chapter 19, verse 20, he had weight loss. Chapter 30, verse 17, he was in continual pain. I believe that. Chapter 30, verse 17, his bones were eroding. Chapter 30, verse 27, he was restless. Chapter 30, verse 30, he had blackened skin. And chapter 30, verse 30, he was suffering with a high fever. I don't know how you diagnose a man like that, but you put on his door, critical condition. And this is not even to mention the social implications of Job's sufferings. Because any form of leprosy or any form of skin disease immediately branded you as unclean. It immediately ostracized you from the rest of the society. Literally, Job was sitting in the garbage dump outside the city gate. It was the only place they'd let him stay, was outside the city gates where they threw over the garbage. You know, here was a man that was man of the year. Here was the guy who had the keys to the city. And immediately, overnight in a sense, he finds himself sitting in the garbage dump, alienated from his friends, stripped from his business, sitting there in the garbage dump. The man of the year has become the ulcer of Uz. Terrible plight. Now, whenever you see a man in such desperate situations, it's always nice to know that there is a loving, supportive wife behind him. You know, a woman who's fixing to come to his aid and to encourage him and to strengthen him and, you know, put him back on his feet. And so his wife said to him, "Do you still hold your integrity? Won't you curse God and die?" Now, literally, in the Hebrew, she says, "Why don't you bless God and die?" But she says it in such a satirical tone. "Oh, why don't you bless God and die?" She says it in such a satirical tone that the translators pick up on that, and so they accurately translate the meaning of what she said. And in essence, she was just saying, "Why don't you curse God and die? Why
Why don't you go ahead and get it over with, honey? You know, how can anybody bear this? How can anybody stand this? She had suffered a great deal herself. She probably would have been happy to be a widow and to move on with her life and all. But, you know, she just lets her emotions out. Just go ahead. Curse God. Die. You know, you'd be better off. Let me just say, and this costs you nothing extra, but let me just say to the women, you nor your husband really understand the emotional impact you have on his life. He's not even aware of it himself. The power you have over his disposition and over his motivation. You can either build him up or you can tear him down. But your influence and your sway over that man and the man he becomes is tremendous. But notice how Job responds. And I've got to admit that I would not respond to my wife if she had said that to me in the way Job does. I mean, despite the pain, Job remains polite. He still remains diplomatic in face of it all. He says to her, "You speak as one of the foolish women speaks." He doesn't even call her a fool. He just says, "You speak like the foolish women speak. Shall we indeed accept good from God? And shall we not accept adversity?" Interesting question. You know, if we're ready to let God be God in our lives, and if we truly say that whatever God, whatever you want me to have, Lord, you know, I'm yours. If we really mean that, what difference should it make to us whether God decides to give us good or whether God decides to give us adversity? Whether God decides to demonstrate His glory in His greatness towards us through our blessing or through our suffering? What difference does it make? And God does use suffering to bring glory to Himself. If you deny that, you deny your own salvation. Because it was through the greatest act of suffering that He's brought about the greatest glory. And that was through the cross and passion of Jesus Christ. Notice what it says here, that in all this, Job did not sin with his lips. And I really believe that the Holy Spirit threw that in here just for the positive confession bunch. Because some of these people that call themselves Bible teachers, when they teach the book of Job, they like to point to the fact that Job, or they like to try to teach that Job made a negative confession. And that the reason that all this has come upon Job is because he had made a negative confession. He's just now receiving what his words, you know, requested. What does the Bible say? It says, in all this, Job did not sin with his lips. Nothing displeasing to God came from Job's lips. When Job faces his sin, when Job faces his difficulties and he admits them, and when he just acknowledges reality, that was not displeasing to God. You know, God doesn't mind if we're real. If we're sick, God doesn't mind that we say we're sick. God doesn't mind us being real and being honest with ourselves and with our predicament. You know, it's just true that when you become a Christian, God doesn't promise you a bed of roses. It rains on the just and the unjust. You know, as a believer, you're going to suffer just like somebody else would suffer. I mean, there's no guarantee of immunity for the person who comes to Christ. The guarantees that God makes is that while you're suffering, God is going to be with you. He's going to guide you. He's going to strengthen you and comfort you. But He doesn't guarantee you that you won't suffer. See, that's the difference. If we never suffered, how could we be a witness to the world? I mean, we're a witness to the world because God places us in the same plight as everybody else. But then God comes along and He strengthens us and supports us and encourages us. And suddenly people look at us and He's experiencing what I'm experiencing. But look how He's victorious over it. Look how triumphant His attitude is. And that's how God gets glory. C.S. Lewis again said, "Why should the righteous suffer? Why not? Only the righteous can handle it." That's true. Now, when Job's three friends Let me say one other thing. Whenever I read the book of Job, I am always reminded of the fact that Job himself never had the privilege and opportunity to read the first two chapters of Job. You ever thought about that? Now, we're looking on this whole thing and we see meaning and purpose in what Job is going through. That's only because we have the prologue to the story. We have the program notes. But God didn't have the program notes. Job didn't have the program notes. God did. And that's the problem with suffering. It's one thing for us to look on at your suffering. And by the way, I learned the definition of minor surgery a long time ago. It's surgery that happens on somebody else. That's minor surgery. It's always major surgery when it happens to you. But you know, we can look on your suffering and we can all kind of sit back glibly and we can say, oh, brother, you know, God is going to bless. God is doing this. This might be some kind of cosmic test. You know, it's easy when it's you. But with me, when I begin to suffer, I don't have the program notes. You know, it's not before me. I don't really know what God's doing. And yet, despite the absence of that information, Job was faithful. And he submitted to the sovereignty of God without complaining, without arguing over whether he deserved this, without trying to fix the blame on somebody else or blaming his servants for not watching over his flocks or, you know, whatever. You know, Job didn't do anything. He submitted to the sovereignty of God and he blessed God even in the face of his suffering. Now, the one thing that does give Job a bit of a problem later, and we'll see it next week, and that is that if God had told Job why these things had happened, Job, you know, freely admits, I would have had no problem suffering. It wasn't the boils, it wasn't the losses that bothered Job. What bothered Job was that all this had happened to him and he didn't know why. And this is where Job sins. In asking why, Job loses his way, as we'll see. And this is the real problem, knowing why. And that's what the whole book of this whole book is about. Is do we really have to know why? Or is there something more about God that we need to learn? Is there something that we can only learn in the face of unanswered questions? Now, when Job's three friends heard of all this adversity that had come upon him, each one came from his own place, Eliphaz the Temanite, Bildad the Shuhite, and Zophar the Naamathite. For they had made an appointment together to come and mourn with him and to comfort him. And we should put that in italics, comfort him, if that's what you want to call it. You know, you've heard the old expression, you know, if that's what his friends do to him, I'd hate to see his enemies. Well, listen, if these are his friends, I would hate to see his enemies. You know, somebody once said, pick your friends, but not to pieces. What happens for the next 38 chapters is that Job's friends pick him to pieces. That they come at him with this faulty theology, telling him why these things, that bad things just don't happen to good people. That they had this naive idea that we grew up with. You grew up with it. It's sort of something you picked up somewhere along the line. You maybe got it from Sunday school or something. And that's the idea that God punishes those that are bad. He rewards those that are good. And that's always the way God works. That the righteous never suffer and the wicked never prosper. But then we get out to the real world, we realize that that's not the case. And that you can't judge someone's status with God on circumstantial evidence. You can't look at what they're going through and conclude where they are with God, because the righteous sometimes do suffer innocently and with no reason, or no apparent reason. And sometimes the wicked are blessed, and again, for no apparent reason. And that doesn't work out in real life. And you see, if you've got that kind of naive theology tonight, you need to grow up. You need to understand the sovereignty of God. And as we read the story of his three friends and what they say to Job, we're going to recognize in their counsel some of our own faulty theology. Some of our own conclusions that we've drawn from time to time about ourselves and about others. And we're going to recognize that faulty theology is dangerous. That it can destroy a person. You see, now Satan brings out his heavy artillery, in a sense. You know, the losses and the boils are minor compared to the torment that Job's three friends put him through. And the torment that they'll put you through for the next 30 chapters as we go through it. Now, Eliphaz, he is the diplomatic one. And we call him Eliphaz the Eloquent. Bildad is blunt. And so we call him Bildad the Brutal. Zophar is even blunter. And so we call him Zophar the Zealous. And so these guys just, you know, it goes from bad to worse. We'll see three cycles of arguments here. Eliphaz will start. He's probably the oldest. And he'll start with his argument. And then Job will answer it. And then Bildad will start with his argument. And then Job will answer it. And then Zophar. And then Job will answer it. And it goes on like that. Three cycles. And we'll cover that next week. Dave Shimack and I were arguing before the Bible study tonight about who the smallest man in the Bible was. And I told him, I said, I was sure that it was Nehemiah. But he argued with me and he said, no, he says, right here, it's Bildad the Shuhite. So, and then in verse 12, and when they raised their eyes from afar and they did not recognize him, they lifted their voices and wept. And each one tore his robe and sprinkled dust on his head toward heaven. And so they sat down with him on the ground 7 days and 7 nights. That was the period for mourning the death of a friend. 7 days and 7 nights. So they literally considered him dead, in a sense. They mourned him as if he were a dead man. And no one spoke a word to him, for they saw that his grief was very great. Now, these are genuine friends. There's nothing glib about their commitment to Job. I mean, they come and they sit down with him. They mourn with him. They weep with him. They have sincere motivations. They have genuine concern for Job. But as we'll see, genuine concern is not enough when it's coupled with faulty theology. If you want to comfort a friend. So we'll conclude there tonight. We'll cover more ground next week. It is possible to get bogged down in some of these dialogues, and we'll try to keep ourselves from doing that. And so we'll start covering more territory at this point. Let's pray, and then we'll open it for any questions you might have. Lord, we thank you for the lessons that we learn in the book of Job. Lord, where do we begin to search our hearts and to apply the things that we've learned tonight? Lord, I guess we should begin with our own faith. Why do we follow you, Lord? What's behind our allegiance to you? Is it a genuine faith? Or is it simply a meal ticket? What's been our reaction when we suffered? Have we denied you? Have we complained and argued with you? Or have we accepted your sovereignty as God, as Job accepted it? Lord, help us to serve you not for what we can get out of you, but for who you are. Because you're worthy, because you deserve it. Lord, help us in the days ahead as we continue to study the book of Job. Help us to learn what to say and what not to say when our friends suffer. Lord, help us not be an Eliphaz or Bildad or Zophar. But Lord, help us to learn wisdom. And help us to learn, Lord, as we go through here at church in the book of Job, Lord, may you take us through in our own lives the lessons of your sovereignty. May you teach us, Lord, who you are And may we let You be God in our own lives. Lord, I really believe that if we will grasp that lesson, our lives will be changed forever. Lord, speak to us. In Jesus' name, amen.